Will you please join me in the Serenity Prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. All right, please respect our speaker and silence your cell phones. Our speaker is being recorded with his or her permission, her, tonight. CDs can be purchased from Darren. I'd like to introduce this evening's speaker, Kathleen from San Clemente.
Hi, I'm Kathleen, alcoholic. Oh, it's good to be here. I thought there would just be a handful of us locals, and I could wing it, but hopefully I'll have somewhat of a message. A lot of newcomers, a lot of out-of-towners, welcome, welcome. It's good recovery in San Clemente. Now, thinking of Thanksgiving, my first try at rehab, I was in a psych ward in the cafeteria Thanksgiving, having cafeteria food, but it was like I felt safe for the first time in probably like 20 years. You know, it's scary being out there using and drinking alone, and it's a big, mean world out there. So we get safe here, and we get protection and fellowship and a lot of love. A lot of love and a lot of healing. I just came from my woman's book study downstairs on the porch step, and so much power in just doing the steps and what we can overcome from our past and get to the sunny side of the street and the sunny side of life. But they did an intervention at work. I worked at a chemical dependency psych hospital, Capo by the Sea, in Dana Point. It was on the bluff, and I don't know how many acres, I think like 30 acres up there, and catered to a lot of the rich lawyers' wives with depression, and we had a couple movie stars, and had a beautiful grounds. I had moved down from Alaska in 90 after hitting the bottom up there, and got a job at Capo by the Sea Hospital as a patient account rep. And my year evaluation there, my boss calls me into the office and she says, you know, you work really well with the patients. I was discharging them and finding them insurance benefits for recovery homes. And didn't know anything about AA. And she goes, but you just seem really despondent, like you have this black cloud over your head. And usually it's on Mondays. It seems like you're hurting. And for some reason, I looked at her, and I think for the first time in my life, I don't remember anybody asking how Kathleen was doing, that I wasn't doing so well. And I broke down, and I said, you know, I'm lonely, I'm isolated, I'm a single mom, I'm trying to do this deal, and I have, I'm sure, a handful of excuses and blaming everything for my demise and poor me. And so she referred me to a psychiatrist, and I loved everybody on the grounds. We had chemical dependency counselors, and we had psychologists and psychiatrists, and I knew them all, great people. It was a great environment, especially for an alcoholic. I always hid my head down when they'd walk by so they wouldn't know that I was, like, either coming down off something or a hangover or, you know, totally in my head. But and I just broke down, so she referred me to the psychiatrist. And so I went to the psychiatrist, and by then I was off cocaine, and I was doing caffeine pills, so it was Vivarin, and they were yellow, and I was smashing them up and snorting them, so I'd have these yellow rings around my nose. And I drank a pint of vodka so I could be this wide-awake drunk and tell her the meaning of life according to Kathleen, and how we're all grains of sand on the face of the universe, and life sucks, and it's hopeless, and, you know, and I'm talking to her, and pretty soon my boss comes in and my coworker, and they said, well, I think, you know, we don't want to send you home. You sound like you're a hopeless alcoholic. And I said, okay. And I guess I was done. I was really sick and tired of being sick and tired at this point. And I was tired and I was alone and exhausted. And So I said, well, I'm going to go out and have a cigarette, and I'll be right back. And so I went out, and there was a bar right across the alley, and it was a Renaissance in Dana Point. And I went in, and it was about noon, and I handed the bartender the card from the psych's office. And I said, call this number. And first I ordered a shot of tequila, a shot of whiskey, and a carafe of wine, so I could have my wine, my shots, and I handed the bartender the card. And he calls the number, and he turns around and looks at me, and he goes, it's too late. And he hung up, and the psychiatrist and my boss and my coworker come into the bar and said, this is the first intervention we've done at a bar. And because I knew they were taking me away, and it was just like I had to have that one more drink, you know. And so it was Charter Hospital. They're closed now, but it was a psych chemical dependency hospital. So I was with the crazies and diagnosed hopeless alcoholic. And but like I said, it was the first time I had felt not alone, like I could have some help, like somebody cared, and safe, you know, because I had been trying to muster up the gumption my whole life, you know, and I found out through doing many inventories that I had this legacy that I was withholding as far as alcoholics were my people, drug addicts were my people. And I was a rebel without a clue, and so I was defending not only my right to drink, but my people's right to drink, and I thought it was a lifestyle choice. But it was actually killing me. And but needless to say, when I got out of there, you know, I felt like they ripped open my guts, said, God, no wonder you drank, you're a mess. Now, you know, go to AA meetings, you can't drink anymore, and kind of put the pieces back together. And I didn't hear, go to meetings, get a sponsor, call people. I just heard, you're a mess and you can't drink. And I remember I went to one meeting and I sat in the back and I had my arms crossed. And it was like, you guys didn't understand. My pain was bigger than your pain. Nobody cares and screw you. And I lasted 30 days. You know, it was Christmas time. And I had 30 days, and I was trying to do the sober Christmas with the sober eggnog and the sober lights and the sober in-laws, and everything was so sober. And I didn't like Christmas because I always, you know, my parents died of this disease when I was a teenager, and it was me and my son, but my ex came to get my son and take him to grandmother's house, and he was a born-again Christian, and I told him I was trying to find God, and I was clean and sober, and he just kind of laughed at me and said, that sounds like an AA slogan. And I remember I felt like slapping him because I was holding on by a thread. And I said, well, it's helping me and that's all I've got. And I started crying and he said, Christmas is over. And he left with my son. And I know now that no alcoholic should be alone on Christmas with 30 days of sobriety and not a phone list and not a sponsor. So what I did is I went and picked up and drank, and because I had a feeling, and I didn't know what to do with it. And it took me 4 of the longest months of my life to make it back, because I never really tried to stop drinking before. It was a choice. It was a lifestyle. It was what I did. It was what I knew. So now when I tried not to drink every day, I drank. I totaled a car in a wide awake blackout because I was still... thought I'd do the Vibrant again, and I was driving home from a bar on Valentine's Day, looking for love in all the wrong places, right? And my arms paralyzed, and I was wide awake, and I just watched myself plow right into the back of a car, and all I remember was like those fenders in the back of Trans Ams, and I just plowed in it, cracked the windshield, my head through it, backed up, went around it, my house was about a half a block, heart, and then went upstairs and drank some more and woke up the next day and said, I'm never going to drink again. And I went out and looked at my car and I had to go drink again because my car is totaled and life's a mess once again. But it was, I remember when I did finally make it back to rehab, I used to drink and think. And I had this old Spanish villa in Dana Point, 3 flights up and these glass windows. And my son would be in the other room with his video and his TV dinner. And I'd have my Bonnie Raitt music and my looking out the window and drinking and thinking and meaning of life and what's it all about, Alfie, and woe is me. And I remember I just got this overwhelming feeling of my dad's presence, that he had committed suicide when I was a teenager. And I finally figured out why. Because I looked out that window and there was no hope. And I made the mistake of calling the psychiatrist and telling her my revelation that now I know why he committed suicide. Because there's no hope. I've tried everything. Needless to say, they came and took me away again. And but this time, I dove into AA because I think that relapse taught me how cunning, baffling, and powerful this disease was. I'm a pretty strong-willed, independent woman, and I could not stop drinking if my life depended upon it. So this time when I got into rehab, you know, I dove in, and I asked the questions, and I opened my ears, and I listened, and I was willing to do whatever they said. And this time when I got out, I dove into AA, and I got the numbers, and I still sat in the back and thought, you didn't care and you didn't understand and my pain was bigger than your pain. But only like the dying could be, I had to reach out and say, I'm Kathleen, I'm an alcoholic, and you know, here I am. You know, help, basically. It's just like, we can't do this alone. And it was scary. It was really scary, but what a journey it's been, you know. And for this alcoholic, my whole life evolved around alcoholism. You know, I saw a lot of deaths. I saw a lot of destruction. You know, I was able to quit drugs because I saw the guns come out, and I saw the abuse, and I saw the narcs, and I saw the jails and institutions and the overdoses. And I said I would never let that happen to me. But I never saw the destruction of alcoholism, even though my father was an alcoholic and committed suicide. My mother overdosed when I was 17. And she was an alcoholic. And I always blamed life, you know. It was always them assholes. It was always those mean people, if only, you know, and nobody understood, and we're just trying to get along and live life. But I never saw the destruction of powerfulness of alcoholism and how it involved every aspect of my being, of my whole belief system. When I came here, I could not believe the defense mechanisms that I had built around my right to drink. Those are my people. It's my lifestyle. I felt disloyal when I got sober. It's like, you know, I was betraying all my fellow addict alcoholics, you know, because the party was over. But I remember I went to the Gucci meeting in Laguna Beach, and there was hundreds of alcoholics, and they were laughing, and they were sober. And I said, this is where my people are. But these people are living, and they're smiling, and they have hope. They're not dying from alcoholism and having those dreams on the bar stools that will never happen. So I was really glad to find my people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I do want to, I remember I was 30 days sober, and I kept having these flashbacks of, you know, a whole life of alcoholism. And when you get sober, it's like all that stuff comes up that I ran away from for so many years, as fast as I could, because life was not going to get me down, you weren't going to destroy me, and I was going to, you know, titch to the walls and run my life and not let anything get me down. And when I got sober, it's like, oh, shit. You know, I had all these feelings and memories and that I had been running from. And I remember one time I had a memory of when my mom was dying. She had a swollen liver, and I was 17, and I came home from the Kern Valley, and there was a big party in the mountains. And she had escaped a crazy lunatic man that was trying to kill us that she married after my dad died. And she had hid in the desert and bought a bar. And she came from quite a bit of money, and so she bought protection around us. And we had Rags, the jukebox man, and we had Pepe, who was an ex-mafioso. We had Carl's, the bartender. And we had, like, this whole little world in the middle of the desert. And we were safe there, and nobody could get us. But I saw my mom. She was a little Irish woman. Her name was Irish Rose. And I saw her all of a sudden. I hated to see her drunk, but I saw her throwing bar bottles across her bar and flipping off these bikers at her bar and telling, you know, people off in her bar. I'm like, Mom, you know, what is the matter with you? I ended up just like that. So much rage, you know, and all this stuff that we don't even know where it comes from. And for me, it was all that, those feelings and that resentment and that anger that I stuffed, and it would come out when I was drunk. I remember one time this biker guy said, you know, he's looking down on me and I'm flipping him off. I come out of a blackout and he goes, you have people problems. I'm like, fuck you. But, you know, where did that come from? I'm a pretty mellow, nice girl, but put some tequila in me and I'll be flipping you off. And yeah, but anyway, so we're at the bar there and we had our own little world. And, you know, I had my people, you know, my drug dealers and bikers, and we had our whole scene going on, and she had her lounge lizards and her desert rats and her scene going on. And but I came home from the mountains, and she had a swollen liver, and, you know, I told her, said, if you ever feel like another drink, I'll roll you a joint. And I remembered that when I was 30 days sober, and I ran out of the meeting. I had so much shame around that, if I could have only helped my mom out, because she was like my best friend. And all she wanted was love, you know, and I didn't realize that she was an alcoholic and couldn't get sober. But she said, you know, I'm tired. I can't do this anymore. And I didn't blame her. And she died from alcoholism. I thought it was a suicide because I thought she could quit drinking, but as sober I got, I realized that she couldn't stop drinking. It wasn't, you know, an intended suicide. It was just alcoholism that killed her. And then I had another flashback when I was in Alaska. I had to go to Alaska when she died. I was 17, and I had a half-sister there that lived on an island. And they worked at a logging camp, and they were building a cabin in this island. And I was running drugs by then, so I shipped up 100 peyote buttons and 2 ounces of Afghani hash, bundled it all up and had a bunch of pot and shipped it up to this island. And there's about 5 heads, you know, long hairs, and we would have square dances on Friday nights, and there was a hot springs. And so we're on this island, and culture shock, and you know, we made some peyote tea, and all of a sudden we're down at the beach and we're barking at these seals that are coming up to the shoreline, and I'm like, oh my God, they're barking at the seals and they're coming up to the shoreline, and the salmon are running up the stream, No, they didn't have a hat. These were real. I have quite a few of these stories, and they tease me. Did they have hats on? No. But, so we're, you know, I'm on this island, and you know, the bar, I was inherited the bar, and when I turned 18, I went back to the Mojave and claimed my bar, and ran it into the ground. In 6 months, the lawyers took the money, the people she lent money for businesses claimed bankruptcy, and I remember sitting on the curb there just feeling emotionally robbed and raped of everything, just like my mom, you know, feeling used. And I, in my inventory, I remember writing at that time was when the walls went up. Nobody was going to mess with Kathleen. Nobody was going to take advantage of me. Nobody was going to hurt me like they did my parents. And that's the legacy I talked about earlier. Is I was defending my mom's right to drink, my dad's right to drink, my right to drink. And nobody was going to get me down. And I think that's the only reason, it's not why I'm an alcoholic, but it's the only reason I lasted so long out there. It was like I didn't get sober till I was 35. And I was 20 years of drinking every day and not letting them get me down. And every year I can date back hitting the bottom where I had to go this way because this really didn't work out. And, you know, and then pull up myself by the bootstraps and try this way. And that really didn't work out. It was always something, you know. I stopped the drugs, so I'd switch from, you know, scotch to randy or scotch to brandy or whatever worked, you know. Trying something, right? Trying something. But in Alaska, I went back up there after I met him. And I had my son. And you know, I was a single mom then, and my ex-husband had left. I asked him for a divorce, and he took off to Dana Point back to California. And I had my son. He was 8 years old, and he was sleeping in the back of the car, and I stopped into this bar for just one drink. And my son was everything to me. I think he's the only reason I kept alive, basically, because I had some pretty dark moments where the meaning of life had no meaning except for my son. And so I went into the bar where he was sleeping in the back of the car, and I came out of a blackout where the sheriff had my son on the stage with a little sheriff's hat on. He had been crying, and they're asking whose son this is. And I don't know how long I was in that bar. I just went in for one drink, and when I had that memory, when I was sober, I could not believe that I would do that. I had forgotten all about that, but what that tells me is, against all odds, I would never leave my son in the back of a car, let alone crying there, you know, hopeless and scared, and I'm an alcoholic, you know, and I ran out of a meeting feeling full of shame, and somebody said, Kathleen, you didn't have a choice. You're an alcoholic. And I learned to separate the disease from who I am. I'm not a bad person. I'm a sick person getting well. And so I had to slowly get through that healing of shame and guilt and remorse of my actions when I was drinking. And that's been a process to this day, you know, through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's wonderful, you know, I remember when I went back into rehab, I isolated the last year of my drinking because you didn't care, you didn't understand, and screw you. So I pushed everybody away, and so I'm sitting there drinking and thinking in my apartment and didn't have anything left to blame. All of a sudden, I'm just left with myself. And it was apparent to me that, you know, my alcoholism was a life of its own. It wasn't them assholes anymore. It wasn't because my parents died. It wasn't because I was a single mom. It wasn't because, you know, karmic enforcer didn't work and life, you know, wasn't ran by nice people. It was because I'm an alcoholic and I needed help. And that was my first step to getting help was, you know, when I went in that treatment center the second time, I asked him, I said, I need a higher power because I can't stop drinking on my own. And he goes, well, what do you think a higher power is? And I said, well, somebody that gives a shit about Kathleen, somebody that cares about me, that'll guide me, that'll, you know, take my hand and say, go this way instead of, you know, up against a brick wall, which I've been doing for 30 years. And he said, okay, well, what do you think he looks like? And I said, well, I used to always sit next to the old men at the end of my bar because they would tell me stories, you know, about their childhoods and the good old days until they had too many drinks and then they turned into dirty old men. But I liked, you know, I felt safe around the wise old men. So my higher power is a wise old man. He said, okay. And I wrote all this down and goes, okay, there's your higher power. And I remember I ripped that piece of paper out and I put it in my back pocket. And I think I carried that piece of paper around so I had a higher power for the first 6 months of my recovery. Until I started coming to believe, where I started seeing the God shots in my life, you know. I started seeing life wasn't so depressing, it wasn't so mean, you know. Things started working in my life where, you know, I started having people I could call. I remember sitting at the phone crying, not being able to think of one person I could call for help. And then looking at the television and watching commercials at the Miller Lights or the coffee even and everybody having fun and I'm all alone, miserable. And it's pretty pathetic when you're crying in front of the television at commercials. But that's where alcoholic took me. It was just a hopeless, isolated, depressing, dark place where I couldn't see any help, you know. And everybody's doing life out there and I couldn't figure out how they were doing it. But when I got sober and I started, you know, hearing the birds chirp and the people saying, how are you doing? And getting phone numbers and going to coffee. It was like all of a sudden I was living that life. I remember my first sober baseball game. It was a picnic at Crown Valley on Memorial Day. And it was like I felt like I was that commercial where everybody's having fun and having friends and we're playing horseshoes and we're having squirt gun fights and, you know, just corny shit, but it was, I wasn't alone dying in my apartment, you know. And I really started enjoying life, and I started getting some hope, you know, from a hopeless place of all of a sudden going, well, you know what, maybe they do care. I remember an old-timer pointing out a coin to me, you know, I was telling him that everybody's doing this and everybody's doing that, and they have family and they have friends, and I'm all alone. And he said, Kathleen, he said, it writes right on the back of our coins, we care. And he goes, we say that for a reason. You have to let us in so that we can care. And I went, oh, because my walls were so thick, because I wasn't going to let you hurt me or, you know, whatever I thought you were going to do, you know, destroy me like you did my parents and not give a shit or whatever. But it was all of a sudden the walls went down little by little. But I had to let you in, you know. I had to start uncovering and discovering and discarding, you know, dropping that rock of all that facade of, you know, my whole belief system and my identity was wrapped around, you know, what drugs I could sell and I owned a bar and who I knew. And all of a sudden all that was dropped and I felt like just, you know, an empty woman. And they said, no, you're not. You just haven't given yourself a chance, you know. There's Kathleen's in there somewhere. It's just like find out what you are, who you want, what you want to be. And I started, you know, asking myself those questions, but it was through inventory and it was through turning my will over every day, being present to the day instead of the past attached to my story, and instead of fear of the future. I remember I would just say, thy will be done every day. And every day the lights turned green and the birds chirped and I put one foot in front of the other and the door started opening. You know, I went back to school and I became a graphic artist. I went to Sober Club Med and had a ball with, you know, probably 1,000 people in Huatulco, and we're all sober alcoholics, you know, going kayaking and having speaker meetings and, you know, doing, they had this trapeze that they do a circus at the Club Med. But we had Sober Club Med. I mean, how awesome is that? You know, and I went to a convention in Australia. They do AA over there. And I went back to Alaska sober and did all the things I thought about while I sat on those bars. You know, I went river rafting and I went to Mount McKinley and I went to Kenai. And, you know, I started living instead of thinking about it. Thinking and drinking, you know, and then nothing ever happening and wondering why and then blaming you because I'm unhappy, you know. I really realized that so much healing takes place when we start being responsible for our own happiness and for our choices. We have choices today. I didn't have choices back then. My world was so small that it was like so limited to all I knew is what I knew, and a lot of that was death and destruction. A lot of that was pretty freaking depressing. And as hard as I tried to get out of it, until I could surrender and stop drinking, I didn't have a chance in hell. I was just headed the right same place my parents were, which was death, you know. And today, it was like last Thanksgiving, I was on my honeymoon with my husband. And we were laid over in Honolulu, and they vouched us a meal ticket and a hotel, and the sun was shining. And I was like, geez, we're stranded in Honolulu on Thanksgiving, darn, you know. And then yesterday we went to the club, and people gave us a turkey to donate, and we broke bread with a bunch of alcoholics because those are my people. Those are my family today, and that's what we do. You know, I hope you newcomers let us in, you know, and let the healing begin, because we are saving lives here. You know, we don't have to dig any deeper into our disease, and we don't have to die from it, and we don't have to attach our story to ourselves. We have hope today, and we can have a life beyond your wildest dreams. And that's just what amazes me is, you know, we can do whatever we want. And a lot of us alcoholics, if we give ourselves a chance, you know, we are pretty cool people. We're creative and we're smart and we're, you know, we have a lot of life in us. Carl Jung talks about, you know, the spirit of alcoholics is we have this need for spirits. Alcoholics has a thirst. And we have to feel that. Instead of feeling it with alcohol, we need to feel it with life and with God and with fellowship. You know, we are not a glum lot. You know, I'm a total believer on having fun in sobriety, and a total believer of nobody should be alone, you know, because we don't have to today. Kind of got railroaded into this, my dear husband, secretaries this meeting, but I'm really glad. I have a love affair with AA, you know, and I love everybody here. I just hope the best for everybody. It's you know, you hear people that go back out, and I get scared about that because we don't make it back in. And I'm kind of glad I had my relapse, in that when I wanted to come back, I couldn't, and it took me 4 months. And it takes near death, institutions and jails, bats over the head for us to surrender and say, okay, I give up. I don't know why, you know, I guess it's fighting that 500-pound gorilla, the devil, whatever it is, but we can't fight it alone. And we have to totally surrender so that we can get help. And, you know, sometimes that's the hardest thing for us to do. And unfortunately, it is, you know, we hit pretty hard bottoms. That's why I'm always so glad to see everybody here, because I know what it takes to get here. And you're here, and you're alive, and you have half of a chance of a good life today. If anything, just half of a chance to be sober and put one foot in front of the other, and whatever you say, chop wood, carry water, and see what happens, you know, versus sitting alone, isolated. You know, the steps are my coping skills. If I was an alcoholic and I didn't have these tools to deal with life, I think I would be neurotic anyway. It was like, I need help dealing with life because I'm very sensitive. And it's like learning to let it go and turn it over to a higher power. It's like, what a relief. I was always the karmic enforcer and everybody was doing it wrong. It was such a burden and life was so heavy, does it? Now it's just like, just let it go. And all I have to do is concentrate on where my feet and my hands are. And if I'm doing right by myself and following my truth, then chances are I don't have to look over my shoulder or make any amends that, you know, I'm probably doing God's will. It's usually what's right in front of me if I'm doing the next right action. You know, and then like I said, the fourth step, cleaning up all that wreckage and seeing the patterns that were ingrained in my head. And I can go back there in a heartbeat with 20 years of sobriety. I got sober April 1st, 92. 20 years of sobriety, I can go back in a heartbeat and say, you don't care, you don't understand, and screw you. And push you away and go down that dark rabbit hole. But I don't go there today. I can recognize it, that I'm pushing you away. I'm getting into self-pity. And my sponsor allows me 24 hours to feel sorry for myself or blame you for my demise, and then I have to snap out of it and get into solution. And usually the solution is asking how you're doing. Or usually the solution is, where did that resentment come from? And it's usually some type of fear that came way back from some asshole that did me wrong a long time ago that I'm still hanging on to, and it's coming out sideways at you because I'm not getting what I need. But if I'm willing to do the work, which I am, because I don't want to live in that hell anymore. I lived in that hell for 20 years. If I'm willing to do the writing, if I'm willing to make the call, if I'm willing to do the prayer, because I want serenity. I want a lifestyle that doesn't live in blame and guilt and shame anymore, or resentment. I want a life that is in peace and in harmony with what I want it to be today. It's up to me to have a shitty day or a good day. And that's a lot of responsibility, but I'm willing to take that responsibility so that I'm the only one that can do anything about it, me and my God, you know. And sometimes I don't do it gracefully or immediately, but at least I'm willing. I realize today I am human. I'm not a saint. I still have character defects, but at least I'm willing to acknowledge them. You know, it's like, oh, shit, I did that again. Or, oh, there I go down that rabbit hole. But, you know, that's how I think I'm sober today, is the willingness to look at some ugly truths about myself, be honest with myself, and say, yep, I don't want to go down there again. Sorry about that, you know. And what's the worst that could happen is I look like a fool. Okay. You know, I have to eat some humble pie. Okay. But my side of the street's clean, and I can do better tomorrow. And I can, you know, have good relationships today. And I can look you in the eye and say, you know what, I've been where you've been. You don't have to live there anymore, you know. And this is what we do to get out of that hell, you know. And it's like, in the 10th step, you know, I've been doing some more inventories of secrets. It's the little secrets that I keep of where I don't want to look bad, or I don't want to think I'm selfish, or I'm in fear about where's mine. And I've just been finding that out. I thought secrets were these big, dark, ugly things. But the secrets are the little things that we don't want to tell anybody because we'll look stupid. And I've heard old-timers going out over secrets because they don't want to let people know that they're hurting inside, or they're having stupid thoughts, or, you know, negative thinking or whatever. And so I've been really cognizant of writing out my secrets and telling somebody about them, telling on myself. Just little stupid shit that's going to come out sideways if I don't talk about it, because I'm allowing myself to be human today. I'm allowing myself to have faults today. But I'm also allowing myself to grow and heal. And I want to grow and heal. I want to live that good life. I don't want to hang on to looking good, being cool, you know, whatever, because that could kill me. You know, I just want to be Kathleen, you know, an alcoholic among alcoholics, my people. And so I'm willing to do the work, you know. And then we've been going to a meditation, an 11-step, sought through prayer and meditation. I do a meditation affirmation book every morning, sometimes two, just to get my head. I wake up and sometimes it's like, oh shit, what am I going to do? You know, we were in a motorcycle accident 3 years ago, and my whole life changed, you know. But I saw the power of Alcoholics Anonymous come full circle, from a hopeless alcoholic crying over the phone with no one to call. Whereas my husband says, you know, the drums beat and the smoke alarms went, and there was hundreds of alcoholics coming to the hospital. I was flown to Palomar. We got hit head on by another motorcycle up in Julie, and I was helicoptered out, and Alcoholics Anonymous came in full force and, you know, carried us through that tough time. You know, we weren't alone through that. But what was I getting at? Oh, the 11th step. Now, it's like I'm not working for the first time in 35 years. I'm on permanent disability. And so I'm having to redefine my lot in life. And I have a lot of time on my hands. But I did meditation when I was bedridden for a year and a half through this. Actually, Lisa's mom would call me from Arizona, and I had a headset on, and she'd do a walking meditation to get me out of my head and out of pain for a half hour over the phone. And it's just doing that thought of not getting in my head of, oh shit, what am I going to do? Where is life going? Why did this happen? Just getting into that peaceful valley where all is okay right now, and being totally present. And it relieves the pain emotionally and physically and spiritually for me. And tomorrow we're going to Tribuca Canyon into a meditation meeting there that Bill W. was at back in the day. And that's been a real awakening for me as why Bill W. thought it necessary for us to have 11th step. And I'm finally getting it after 20 years of sobriety, is to stop the madness in my head. If only for 5 to 10 minutes to have a thought for the day, whether the meditation be on gratitude or being present or whatever, it's just turning that negative thinking into a positive thinking, and continue to do that. It's not letting my mind take me down that rabbit hole into that past dark history and switching it to a positive. And that's a conscious decision I need to make so that I don't live in darkness. And that's the 11th step for me. And it's pretty powerful, you know. Like I said, if only for 5 to 10 minutes, but it's learning to switch off that head. For us, our disease lives in our head, and it's a dangerous neighborhood to go into alone. Believe me, it's dark, there's nooks and crannies, and there's all kinds of scary places. But if we can practice that, it really does help. But it is a conscious effort, you know. It doesn't happen by osmosis. I've learned that too. I was on the fence probably the first 5 years of my sobriety, and then I got into some pain and I almost drank, and I made another surrenderance. It's like I didn't want to drink, and I could make a choice at that time. I wanted sobriety this time, but I had to make a conscious contact with my higher power and take him from out there and bring him into here so I could do business and not sit on the fence and just kind of take responsibility for my higher power and working in my life, you know. So, and then the 12th step is like, I love AA. Like I said, you guys are my family. You know, I hope I always have an extended hand to you and tell you my name's Kathleen, I'm an alcoholic. I hope we extend each other our hands and help each other. If you see somebody standing alone with their head down and their arms crossed, reach out and say, are you doing okay? Because they might not be doing okay. They might be alone in a crowd. We don't want anybody to go home here alone in the crowd. You don't have to. You have to come up to us and say, you know what, I need some phone numbers. I need some help. I'm going crazy in my head. I got this going on and this going on. And it's like, okay, let's go have some coffee. Let's talk. You know? So with that, I just glad that I got to share with you tonight. I'm glad we have a full house here. I hope you guys hang in there and enjoy this ride. It's pretty awesome. Somebody told me I was trying to figure this out when I first came in. They said, Kathleen, just hang on and enjoy the ride. So I hope that's what you guys do, and I'm going to end it there. Thank you.